time now for Inside the Huddle on WILO, hosted by Ken Hartman. This program will focus on area schools and all the sports they have to offer. Ken will speak with coaches and players across the region. Your participation is encouraged. Call now at 659-3338 to discuss local or statewide sports. Inside the Huddle is brought to you by Tony Theofanis, State Farm Insurance, and Susan Casper, State Farm Insurance in Frankfort. Now here's your host, Ken Hartman.
Good Saturday morning to you, and welcome to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm Insurance agents, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis. I'm your host, Ken Hartman. This week's show, we're going to be centering on the effect of the coronavirus on a national level, as well as an in-depth discussion about human rights and racial equality. At 9 o'clock, we're going to be talking with the Minnesota State High School League Executive Director, Eric Martins, who's on the phone with us right now. We'll get to him in just a second. And then at 9:15, we're going to be talking with human rights activist and pioneer for racial equality, Richard Lapchick. And then at 9:45, we're going to be discussing our favorite subjects with the National Federation of State High School Association's Executive Director, Carissa Niehoff. So that's the stage for today's show. And let's get the thing going here with our first guest, and that is Eric Martins, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota High School Athletic School League. Eric, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ken. Thanks so much for calling, and I look forward to being on the show.
I'm looking forward to having you on because, you know, every state, you know, has got a little different situation going, and I know what ours is around here, and we're just trying to kind of see where everybody's at. I think one of the things that's going to be interesting is that Iowa has already kind of started things off with the fact that they have got high school baseball and softball starting Monday. How much are you guys going to be able to gauge on that, if anything?
You know, I think it's going to tell us quite a bit, quite honestly, about how well people are able to address sports at the high school level in a manner that's going to be safe for the participants and also safe for spectators. I know there's an incredible amount of appetite for getting back on the field and on the courts and all of the different activities that we've historically had. And so I think watching that is going to happen for everybody, especially for Minnesota being the northern neighbor of Iowa. We have a number of folks on the border that are looking at that really closely, and we're obviously talking to the Iowa folks and had a call yesterday with 10 different executive directors from the Midwest area to talk about a number of things that are facing each one of our states. But Iowa is certainly front and center with the beginning of their high school season, and again, a good reminder for your listeners is that Iowa typically has their baseball season in the summer. Minnesota is a spring season, and so summer becomes Legion ball and Babe Ruth ball and things like that. It's different than a high school program.
When did you guys officially quit playing last year? I mean, did you get started with the state tournament last year or not?
So in that second week in March, I think it was around the 11th, was a Wednesday, and that was you were right in the heart of it with the cancellation of the Big Ten basketball tournament, kind of midstream. I think there was a day played, and then it was, and we're going to move forward with fans and everything, and then a day later it was completely off, and not only was that tournament, but all of winter sports and all of spring sports in a 24-hour span, and that was a real indicator for everyone. We're reliant on our governor and our Department of Health here in Minnesota, as most states are. And so that Friday was Friday the 13th, quite ironically, and that's when we canceled in midstream our girls' basketball tournament and also a couple of section boys' games as well as the boys' tournament the following week. So we were right toward the end of our winter season, but that shut us down there, and then our spring was on hold until our governor and commissioner of education said distance learning for the remainder of the year for our schools. And when that happened and our kids could not come together for academics, we were no longer able to come together for the purpose of athletics and activities.
I know basketball is a big revenue maker for you, but also hockey is a big revenue maker for you up there, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Those are two of our biggest, along with football. Not unusual, or pretty traditional in most states. But we were fortunate to get our full hockey tournament in. That was important, and we were able to do that. And girls basketball was going really well, and we were down to semifinal Friday and championship Saturday with that tournament. And so unfortunate to lose those opportunities for kids and for those schools. Many upset family members and certainly team members and coaches. Just understanding to a great extent, but just a lot of frustration and sadness at what could have been. And everyone likes to know how that season's going to finish up. So The boys basketball was a significant loss from us from a revenue standpoint. Just like every state association out there, we're trying to figure out the financial picture as we go forward.
And also, but spring sports is not the bigger revenue maker for you, though, is it?
No, spring sports, generally, we just don't have the arena-type activities that bring in the large, large crowds, and we also don't have any revenue generated by broadcast, per se, with the spring activities. And so they actually cost us a touch more than we spend to put those tournaments on, or that we take in, I should say. And so that's about student experience, as everything in our programs are. It just happens that some of them provide some greater revenue. So our spring sports are outstanding and great experiences for kids, but they don't generate more money than what it costs to put them on.
Now, have you guys got your reopening plans out there for the schools for the start of school this coming August?
We do not. We're in an interesting spot, and every state is a little bit unique. So we have what's called a coaching waiver for the summer, which allows our high school coaches to work directly with their players. And that typically runs June 1 through July 31st. And we only allow permission. We don't govern what that looks like. At the same time, we are providing a great amount of guidance and helping our ADs on a regular basis to be prepared for that. So our focus has been summer. We're going to quickly turn to the discussion around fall. But for us, June 15th now is the start of the summer waiver period based on the opening here within the state of Minnesota. Our board of directors moved that start of the summer coaching waiver time frame from June 1 to June 15th. And then they also extended it an additional week on the backside so our coaches can continue to work with our players through August 7th. And then some of our teams that play what's called a zero week in football could start practice on August 10th, but all of our fall activities are scheduled to return on August 17th. And so that's kind of our time frame as we work our way through the summer.
What kind of plans do you guys have in place for football and for fans and those kinds of things? How are you going to kind of try to put that into perspective?
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of information gathering and a lot of discussions. That was a big part of our discussion yesterday with the executive directors of what do you anticipate for fall and what's that going to look like and how are you going to lead your schools through that. And as most states are, we're going to work really closely with our Department of Education, with our activities and all that comes together. And I think about in my former position as a high school principal, a lot of work on details and how you do things within schools. And so I think things like just even passing time and lunches and all of those kinds of gathering situations for students are going to be a strong indicator of how we might be able to do activities. At the same time, our summer activities right now are going to tell us an awful lot about what's effective, and we're going to learn as we work our way through this. Our opening here in June is really all around individual development with as little interaction between students and participants as possible. And that's all about trying to mitigate the spread of the virus, which, as we continue to learn, is primarily through, through droplets in the air and things like that, and that the less we have contact between participants, the less we're going to have issues with the spread. So when I think about fall and what that can be, I think each activity and sport is going to be a little bit different, and we're going to have to try and figure out how can we, maintain the integrity of each of those competitions and each of those athletic pursuits without putting kids in too great a danger.
Do you anticipate football being played with, like, masks and those kinds of things or not? Or are you going to make them optional? Or what's been your thoughts so far?
Yeah, I heard on the opening there that you've got Chris and Ehoff in the later portion of this segment, and she'll be outstanding. The National Federation, just like our state, has a sports medicine advisory committee. And so we're going to lean on them really heavily to say what kinds of, additional precautions can we take? What can be put in place to help keep students and participants safe? And there's already many vendors out there that are trying to market different approaches to try and limit the spread. And certainly, we've seen those plexiglass kinds of welder masks almost that are out and prevalent in medical areas. And we know that visors and so on within a football helmet is a very common thing. At this point, there's just not medical information and data that suggests that, something across the entire face is going to be going to be helpful. I think that we're going to continue to learn more as we work through the next couple of months, and there's more study on that because by far the high schools aren't the only ones that are playing football. Though we have by far the most participants. Our college and our pro friends are going to also be looking an awful lot at what can be done to make that safer. Right now, the recommendation from NFHS is not to add additional equipment in the area of face masks, et cetera, until they recognize the safety quality of each one of those kinds of attachments and what that might be. And so we're asking our folks to remain cautious, use a general face mask, the cloth-type style, when and where it's feasible. But beyond that, not adding the plexiglass attachments and so on.
Okay. What happens if somebody, when they come into the thing, and I assume you're going to test people before they go in, and you know, I'm talking about your athletes and your coaches, I assume that's going to happen. What happens if they go ahead and test positive, then they get sick during a game? Where are you going to take them, and how are you going to handle that?
You know, that's a great question, and I think we've got lots to learn as we go forward, and we're going to continue to address that. And at the same time, I think we're going to follow the national expectations as well as our state requirements on that. You know, obviously, taking students out and this disease is not one that is critical in its first moment. It's critical over time. And so responding quickly and, you know, bringing that student or individual, whether it be a coach, official, or a participant, and getting them basically out of circulation as quickly as possible, and then taking a look at the contact folks of who's been in contact with that particular individual are important. Get them to medical care as quickly as possible, and I think we're going to continue to watch and see what the right things to do are. Right now, quarantine for up to 14 days is the most common way to approach that for everybody else, and get the medical care and assistance for that individual that's needed as quickly as we can to make sure that they are stable and able to return to health.
I think, you know, even though you don't have anything super specific in place, you sound extremely confident in what you guys are thinking about doing is going to work for you this come the school year.
You know, I think extremely confident is probably an overstatement. I think what we're going to do is we're going to continue to work really hard with the medical professionals. They continue to, you know, get more and more data, identify more clearly what causes are, what the best approaches are, what really is the greatest cause of transmission, and how do we limit that. Our hope, obviously, from a activity situation is that the spread slows way down and we have fewer and fewer folks impacted by this. And then when it comes to activities, that student-age individuals still remain relatively resilient to that. And if those numbers start to change, that's going to be highly concerning, and that will be a determinant for us. But if our students largely stay safe and the number of cases is very, very minimal, you know every case is important, but if it stays minimal, that allows for more interaction and what many folks refer to as getting back to what we kind of knew as normal.
Right.
And so I know it's going to look very different, but that's where we're going to be at. And again, we're going to stay in alignment with our Department of Health. You know, you recognize that there's legal ramifications to that as well, and we continue to remind our schools to be thinking about those kinds of things. And don't let the want or the desire to get in the way of just good practices as you go forward based on what we know at this time.
Okay. Eric, anything else you want to add before I let you go?
You know, it's great to be a part of the high school league and the state associations, and we think that we've got a great experience for our student athletes and student participants. Minnesota has both athletics and fine arts within the state high school league, and you know, we're going to work really hard with our schools to try to make sure that we can have some opportunities. It's very clear that there's lots of families and individual students that are hurting from the lack of opportunity, something that they've been used to for a very, very long time. And so to whatever extent that we can promote that within the bounds of safety, we're going to work really hard to do that.
Best of luck to you. And I think a lot of people got a lot of stuff that's going to work this fall. Let's hope everything works as it's supposed to. So
we certainly are hoping so, and we're anxious to get there, but at the same time, we'd love to know more. So
yeah.
The more information and the safer people are, the better off we're going to be.
That's exactly right. Eric, thanks so much for your time. Greatly appreciate it, and best luck to you guys.
Absolutely, Ken. You stay well. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right. Bye-bye. That's been Eric Martins, who is the executive director of the Minnesota State High School League. We're going to take a break now. You're listening to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agents, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis.
State Farm agents are one of a kind. They understand insurance and share a genuine concern for others. State Farm agent Susan Casper works very hard every day to help people find the right products for their insurance and financial needs. From homeowners and renters to retirement planning, please call Susan Casper today to talk about which products are best for you. Get to a better state. State Farm.
Your free local online newspaper, ClintonCountyDailyNews.com, is your number one resource for information as you need it. Right at your fingertips, we have news, weather, sports, obituaries, the WILO program schedule, over 40,000 community photos, online surveys, community events, and WILO TV archives. Plus, click on the info tab to find out how you can contact your local and state representative. Find out what the buzz is all about. ClintonCountyDailyNews.com.
WILO wants to hear from you. Let us know your opinion by sending us an email. We now have a sound off page at ClintonCountyDailyNews.com. Just go to the community page and click on Sound Off to submit your opinion. We've made it easy for you to sound off on the local issues important to you. You can also submit by emailing your opinion to newsroom@casperradio.com. Let us know what's on your mind. One more way we're keeping you connected. WILO.
WILO and Casper Media are members of the exclusive International Broadcasters Idea Bank. Casper Media and 99 other broadcasters from around the world come together to trade ideas on how to better serve our communities and our listeners. A member of the International Broadcasters Idea Bank since 1991, Casper Media has hosted the Idea Bank Convention throughout the years. Casper Media and Idea Bank, constantly working to better serve you. Depend on WILO.
As an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agents, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis. I'm your host, Ken Hartman. Many thanks to Eric Martins, who is the executive director of the Minnesota State High School League, for his input on what's been going on with the coronavirus. Our next guest is going to be talking strictly about what's been going on now for the last couple of weeks. It deals with racial equality, human rights, and all that kind of thing. We had a chance to interview Richard Lavchik, who is going to be our guest. Richard is a, as we said, a human rights and racial equality discussion. Please pay very close attention to what Richard has to say. I think you're going to find this extremely interesting. And so here's that interview we had a little bit earlier this week with Richard Lavchik. Joined now by Richard Lavchik, who is a human rights activist, pioneer for racial equality, expert on sports issues, scholar and author. He's also the president for the Institute of Sports and Social Justice, chairman of the DeVos Sports Business Management Program at the University of Central Florida, and director of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports. Did I leave out anything?
No, that made me tired listening.
That's true. First of all, since we're going to be talking about a report card that you guys put out on racial and gender for 2019 here, how did you get involved in this to start with?
I'm going to have to go way back because it started way back.
That's all right. It's okay.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm fine. We're here.
Okay. When I was 5 years old, I looked outside my bedroom window and saw my father's image swinging from a tree with people under the tree picketing. And for several years after that, I'd pick up the extension phone in our house, my dad not knowing I was listening, and it was racial epithet after racial epithet being hurled at him. And as a 5-, 6-, and 7-year-old, I didn't really know what that meant, except a lot of people didn't like my best friend in the world. And I would later realize that as the coach of the New York Knicks, he had signed the first African-American player in the history of the NBA, and there were a lot of people who weren't happy about that. He was also a triple inductee into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and everybody told me I'd play in the NBA, which I loved that idea, so I pursued it pretty hard. I was one of the tallest players in the New York City area in the 8th grade and was heavily recruited and did not go to, but became friends with the coach of a school called Power Memorial High School. He invited me to his startup basketball camp in 1961, and there were 5 other white guys and a black guy there. And one of the white guys was hurling the N-word at the black guy for the first 3 days, and I finally challenged him. He knocked me out cold. The black guy's name at the time was Lou Alcindor, became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Right.
And a lifelong friendship began that when Kareem's statue was unveiled at the Staples Center, he asked me to speak at it. When he went to the White House to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he invited me to be his guest. He flew here to Orlando to be with me when I was scheduled to have surgery. So it's been a rich, long friendship. But as a 15-year-old white kid from an almost all-white community, I suddenly had a young, urban African-American lens with which to see what racism was doing in America. And I decided then, as a 15-year-old, I was going to spend my life working on the issue of race. And I didn't know what that would mean at that point, but I knew I wanted to do that. I went and got a PhD in international race relations, did my doctoral dissertation on how South Africa used sport as part of its foreign policy and the international response to it during the apartheid era, and compared it to how the Nazis had done that in the 30s. It got published as a book. I ended up being asked to speak a lot on it. I founded the Sports Boycott of South Africa, and in 1978, the first South African team was coming to the United States. It was a Davis Cup team that was going to play in Nashville, Tennessee, and I went down there to try to build a protest and get the matches canceled. The African government had asked me to announce that they would boycott the L.A. Olympics in 1984 if this team was allowed to come. So when we held a press conference on Monday, all 3 networks were there. Dick Schaap, who was a correspondent for NBC Nightly News at the time, came up to me after the press conference before I spoke to the students and said the financial backers had pulled out. It looked like the matches were going to be canceled. I felt, as I flew home to Virginia that night, that maybe I had done something worthwhile for the first time in my life. The next night I was working late in my university office. The office was in the library, which closed at 10:30. At 10:45, there was a knock on the door. I opened the door expecting it to be the campus security just doing a routine check because they saw a light on. But instead it was 2 men wearing stocking masks who proceeded to cause liver damage, kidney damage, a hernia, concussion, carve the N-word in my stomach with a pair of office scissors. Laying in the hospital that night, I realized that if people had gone to the length they had done to try to stop my dad 28 years before and to the length they went that night to try to stop me, that they must have thought we were having an impact on racism. So I decided that I would spend the rest of my life using the sports platform to address issues of racial justice as well as other social justice issues. And I have done that.
When you look at what's going on currently, does that take you back a few years, or do you think we're getting there, or where do you think we're at with all of this?
I think that this is different. This is a gut feeling. I think that, you know, I'm sure what you're referring to is not only what happened to me and my dad, but, mm-hmm. you know, growing up in the civil rights era and watching everything that had happened, particularly in the South during that era, and then in various incidents throughout my life, and seeing people demonstrate and express their anger after each one of them, but never seeing it really sustained so that real change came about. But now I feel that a combination of things is making this different. I think Generation Z and the millennials are a more passionate, compassionate, and social justice conscious generation. On top of that, they have access to smartphones, which have changed the nature of what we see. I mean, when I was growing up in the civil rights era, I would see still photographs in newspapers about some of the horrific acts that took place. But now when you see literally a man murdered in front of your eyes and watch the life literally go out of them, it's a different kind of feeling. So they can capture all those moments, and they're not debatable once they're on film. They also have social media at their access that they can spread the word and organize much more effectively and more quickly. And I think a third factor, and your interest in the world of sports, and I'm from the world of sports, is the fact that we now have a significant number of athletes who have become activists on social justice issues. 5 years ago, there wasn't anybody in the world of sport that was doing that. Yesterday, 1,400 athletes and people from the world of sports signed a letter to Congress demanding action on certain political issues involving racial justice. And I think the combination of those things make it a different time and make me feel that we might be able to sustain this and bring about some meaningful changes that are being openly discussed now.
How much are the white participation by the white athletes, especially the ones who have some names, plus the fact that the Confederate flag is now being banned by NASCAR, and that's something I never thought I'd see the end of. How much does that make a difference in this case?
Well, I think that not only is it white athletes involved, but when you look at photographs and film of the demonstrations themselves, they're extremely diverse. And the world of sport itself is the most diverse workplace that we have in America, with the possible exception of the military. And I think having those forces united of different racial groups is really important. I think I see for the first time and hear for the first time white people listening to what black people are saying and trying to absorb the pain that they have gone through by and large as a group of people. When I was attacked in 1978, a number of people said to me, well, now you understand what it feels like to be black. And I said, I really don't, because I can walk away from the fight anytime and rejoin the white middle class and never face discrimination again. But if you're somebody who's black or a person of color, you can't just walk away. You are black or a person of color and face those forms of discrimination.
In your mind, how far away are we from basically eliminating this issue?
Well, as I said earlier, I was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement, and I remember that South Africans in particular thought that once Nelson Mandela became president in 1994, that everything would get better right away. They expected equal education, housing, medical services, but they forgot that this took 200 plus years to create that system of oppression, so it couldn't happen instantly. I think it's not going to happen instantly in the United States, and I think we're going to see pieces of it happen all around the country. There's so much talk about police reform and the policing issue right now, but it's, you know, the bottom line for us in America to understand is that the Forbes list of 100 wealthiest Americans have an aggregate wealth greater than all 42 million African Americans combined. That's a lot to overcome, and it's going to have to be addressed systematically and over a substantial period of time.
When you did the 2019 College Race and Gender Report Card, it showed some gains, but not as many, not as much as I'm sure you'd like to have seen. So how far away are we from getting to the point where you will be somewhat satisfied with what the report card tells you?
Well, we can't have 57% of our Division I football players being African American and 10% of our head coaches being African American. In basketball, we have a similar percentage of African American student athletes, and we have 24% of the coaches are African American. In 2006, 24% of the coaches were African American. We are exactly where we were 14 years ago. So I'm a long way from being satisfied. We're certainly what we base the grade on is the percentage of whatever the occupation is, equal to the percentage of the people in the population. We don't do it based on the percentage of people playing the sport, because that would, I think, be an almost impossible goal to reach. But based on the population, if they're proportional, I think that would be good. And there are in the league offices, they've met that. In professional sport at the NCAA headquarters, they've met that. So there are definitely areas where it's improved. But on a gender basis, when you look at probably the most startling statistic for me in that report, is that 48 years after the passage of Title IX, calling for equal opportunity for women and girls in sport, among other areas, 60% of all the head coaches across all three divisions are men. Mm-hmm. 50% of all assistant coaches of women's teams are men.
Right.
I speak a lot on college campuses, and I ask athletic directors, would you hire a woman to coach a men's team? And they look at me like, I heard you were crazy, Lapchick, but I didn't think you were that crazy. Yet 60% of the women's teams are
right. I thought in this article I've got here that I got off of ESPN, and in this one paragraph I think says it all. It says, in the graduate program at UCF where I'm a professor, any grade below a B is considered not passing. A student is not allowed one C to be able to remain in the program. Two of the three grades for college sports were below a B. But that's an improvement, though, wasn't it?
It was a very slight improvement, yes. They went, I think, from 77% overall to about 78.3% or something, and, mm-hmm. and it kept them as a C+, but it was an improvement on the racial grade, for sure.
But basically, overall, what we're saying is that basically everybody, with the exception of the NCAA, is moving slowly forward. Nobody else is even making strides, are they?
The colleges and universities are very far behind.
And the pro sports are just about as far behind, aren't they?
The NBA and WNBA do very well. Major League Soccer does pretty well. The NFL and Major League Baseball are very far behind, particularly in the coaching and general manager ranks.
Okay. What is it going to take, in your mind, for us to get this taken care of? And, you know, it's definitely not going to be an overnight fix, though, is it?
It's not going to be overnight, and I think that, you know, we've got things like the Rooney Rule in place that are starts, but I think the thing that's going to make a difference now is if athletes raise their voice about this issue as they're raising it about other issues in society, I think we'll see change come about much quicker. I think if athletes, and you know, we say in the world of sports, even at the highest levels, that diversity is a business imperative, that's good for business. Well, on a team, if the African-American players believe that the search processes, even if they choose a white guy in the end, because that's certainly possible, but as long as they see that the search process was open, there were people who had the abilities to do the job from all racial groups, or depending on what the job is, including genders, then they're going to feel more comfortable with the organization. They're going to play harder for the owner if they believe the owner's fair.
What do you think sports are going to look like here in the next few years? And this includes with the coronavirus and all the stuff that's happened with that. How do you envision what the sports world may look like? And if you want to take a little bit of the academic world with it, please be my guest.
Well, if you mean in the short term, it's going to obviously look very different. I live in Orlando. We've got Major League Soccer and the NBA playing out this entire season at Disney's Wide World of Sports, which was designed essentially for high-profile youth to play sports. I think it's a good compromise because they want to protect the players. Do we have a vaccine that protects people in the future? I think that's going to be a determining factor. Are we going to ever return to sport as it is normally played with fans, lots of fans in the stands, and you know, as we remember it, not that long ago. But that aside, I think we're going to see athletes continue to be active. I think you're going to see other leagues realize that the NBA has an enviable position because the players and the teams seem to and the league office seem to trust each other and believe in each other. And I think as that happens, and if that happens in the other sport, that it'll be a much more less cantankerous relationship between players and owners and the teams. And if, you know, all the leagues now have said our players can protest, we're not going to take sanctions against them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important first step for the players believing in who they're playing for.
How important in your mind is an antidote for this, if there really is one?
I don't think there's one. I think it's a multifaceted approach. If you're asking me, do I think it's going to get better? I continue to do what I do because I hope it will.
Mm-hmm.
I think the world of sport is symbolic for the rest of America, because it's the only place where when that team gathers in the huddle, I can't think of any other place in our society where it doesn't matter if you are white or black or Latino or Asian American or Arab American, whether you're Protestant, Catholic, Buddhist, Sikh, Jew, Hindu, Muslim, gay, or straight, come from a rich family or poor family, a team can't win if you don't pull together as a team. if we take that spirit into our front offices, into corporate America, into higher education in America, into faith-based America, what a different place this would be.
Are we close to having no sports in your mind if the coronavirus isn't in check or the racism doesn't be kept in check? Are we close to not having any sports at all?
I don't think that racism would stop sports. I think the coronavirus could.
Okay.
I think people will, you know, try to continue to improve opportunities for equality in sports, but I don't ever see a possibility of sports ending because of racism.
And sports is such a very important part in our society. I'd hate to see it go and not be around here anymore.
I think you have a chorus behind you.
So, Richard, is there anything else we would like to bring up that we haven't talked about as of yet? Or
No, you had a great series. I mean, I probably am doing 10 interviews a day, and those were the best series of questions that I've been asked in all of them. You did a really good job preparing.
Well, I greatly appreciate that. And in the article that was on ESPN Online is where I got the majority of the stuff I got. So, all right. Hey, we greatly appreciate it. When's the next one of these report cards going to come out? Is that going to be a while, or are you going to come up with something else prior to that?
In 2 weeks, we issue the one that compares all the sports together, and then we start again with Major League Baseball.
If there is Major League Baseball this
right.
year.
That's the big ass, yep.
Okay. Anything else real quick before I let you go?
No. Nice job. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, and best of luck to you. And I'm sure we'll be running into you down the line a little further, okay?
I'll look forward to that.
All right, Richard, thanks very much. Take care of yourself.
Nothing.
All right.
That was Richard Lapchick, who was a professor down at the University of Central Florida. He was talking about he's a human rights activist and pioneer for racial equality. We've been talking about the 2019 College Racial and Gender Report Card here for the last 17 and a half minutes. It was a great time talking to Richard this earlier this week. I really appreciate his time. We're going to take another break right now, and you're listening to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agent, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis.